and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a unique insight into the mind and motivations of America's number one enemy at the moment, the Islamic State. Suad McKennett, a correspondent for the Washington Post National Security Desk, who was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University and is a visiting fellow at the Weatherhead Center for International Policy at Harvard, the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and the Geneva Center for Security Policy. She joins us to discuss how she got access to leaders of the Islamic State, and although she was unsure whether she would end up kidnapped and held hostage, she was able to interview them for her new book, Just Out, I Was Told to Come Alone, My Journey Behind the Lines of Jihad. We will look into the reasons why young Muslims who grew up in the comfort and safety of Europe join ISIS and conduct acts of terrorism against their host countries. We'll also examine the role of Wahhabi mosques and recruiters in prisons, as well as Saudi Arabia itself, where much of the money and spiritual guidance for anti-Western terrorism comes from. Then we'll look further into Saudi Arabia's petrodollar finance spread of their austere, reactionary, and anti-Western state religion, Wahhabism, which they have exported around the world, that has already destabilized Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Bosnia, and has now taken hold in the world's largest Muslim country, Indonesia. We'll speak with Stephen Kinzer, an award-winning foreign correspondent with the New York Times, who is now a visiting fellow at the Watson Institute at Brown University, where he teaches international relations. We'll discuss his article at the Boston Globe, Saudi Arabia is Destabilizing the World, and why the U.S. continues its willful blindness towards the damage done by Saudi Arabia's long campaign to drag the world's 1.8 billion Muslims back to the 7th century while inspiring murder and mayhem from 9/11 to Nice, from Mumbai to Manchester. And joining us now is Suad McKennett, who is a correspondent for the Washington Post National Security Desk, who has also reported on terrorism for the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, and NPR. She's the co-author of The Eternal Nazi, Children of Jihad and Islam. And she was a 2012 Nieman Fellow at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at the Weatherhead Center for International Policy at Harvard and the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Her latest book just out is I Was Told to Come Alone, My Journey Behind the Lines of Jihad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Suad McKennett.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure, Suad. And what's your sense of where we stand now in terms of these two cities under siege, Raqqa and Mosul? Enormous civilian casualties as collateral damage, if you will. But the expectation is that soon the Islamic State will be conquered, crushed, whatever word you want to use. But that doesn't mean it's the end of it, surely.
No, it's not the end of it, Ian. You said it right. And it's actually, you know, I find we are in a kind of like a similar situation. If you remember when the camps of Al Qaeda were attacked in Afghanistan, or when Osama bin Laden was killed, a lot of people had the idea that okay, that's it, that's going to be the end of terrorism, that's the end of Al Qaeda or of you know, this whole network. But here we are now. The son of Osama bin Laden is emerging as one of the new leaders inside Al Qaeda. And we actually also are dealing with ISIS at the moment. And I'm saying this because some people might have the impression that just by the fact that the so-called Islamic State or Caliphate might, you know, lose ground in Raqqa or in Mosul or in Deir ez-Zor, that this would mean that this would be the end of the whole network. But it's not. You know, ISIS, as I describe in one of my chapters, in actually the opening chapter of I Was Told to Come Alone, I interviewed one of the one person who's in the leadership of ISIS in 2014. And even back then already, when I asked him, when I said, so do you really believe that the countries, that Western countries and other countries will allow you to just go on with your, you know, state of terror and taking over more land and so on? And he said, well, maybe not, but you know what? If they attack us with fire, we will attack them back with fire. And so why am I telling you this? Because the so-called caliphate and the group ISIS was preparing for the day where they would get attacked. And we see that if we watch their media outlets, they have their own news agency, they have a lot of interactions on social media in different languages from different regions. So when you see all this, you realize that this network, that this group has actually spread into different countries as well.
But in terms of the sort of bravado, if that's the right word, that the leader that you spoke with in 2014, the leader of the Islamic State, martyrdom, of course, being a big part of it, how do you reconcile that idea of martyrdom, on the other hand, of wanting to be the new caliphate? They seem like an inherent contradiction.
Well, they believe that this is part of the culture or the ideology of the caliphate, that you know, if you get killed or if you become what they call a martyr during one of the operations, well, you will then go into heaven and you will, you know, you will be blessed, your family will be blessed. That's what their ideology is telling them. I mean, they are copy and pasting many things out of the Quran, out of context, and they are, I would say, they are creating their own ideology around that. And that's the other very, very important thing we have to understand to them. At least that's what they tell us. Whether they really believe it, that's a different thing. But they would say, yeah, you might like and love this life here, but we actually we are looking forward to what is coming after we died. So you know, you like the life here in this world, and we actually you know, we prepare for what is coming after this. And And we see that if we die in one of the terrorist attacks or the fightings, we will actually become martyrs. So it's a very, very it's very difficult for us to understand and to swallow. And I found myself sometimes in situations when I sit with those men, where first of all, I mean, they know that I am not the typical Muslim woman, the way they would like to see women. You know, I'm married. I work for Western media. I grew up in the West. I'm a child of the West, and I challenge them. So when I go into these meetings, I do also, you know, I challenge them, because what I find very interesting is, they don't speak to me about religion very often. They talk to me about politics. They talk to me about, you know, what pushed them into the arms of recruiters. It's in the case of people who came from Western countries, and we should not forget many of those who joined ISIS were born and grew up in Europe. The attackers of London, the attackers of Manchester, the attackers of Paris and Brussels, those were all mainly people who were born and who grew up in Europe. And to understand what drives somebody into the arms of recruiters, that is what I'm doing in I Was Told to Come Alone. I'm taking the reader with me into these meetings, and in order to basically also dismantle not only the ideology, but also how recruiters are able to bring on those young men and women who grew up and who were born in the midst of our societies.
And again, I'm speaking with Suhad McKennett, who is a correspondent for the Washington Post National Security Desk. She's also reported on terrorism for the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, and NPR. And her latest book just out is I Was Told to Come Alone, My Journey Behind the Lines of Jihad. And obviously, I want to talk to you about how these meetings were set up, and in general, the idea that I imagine a part of your motivation was that we have a desperate need to understand the enemy. It is no small irony to my mind that we can't even figure out a name for these people. It's, you know, one day it's ISIS, ISIL, Daesh Islamic State. But let me just touch on what you just said, Suhad, about this paradox of young Muslim Europeans growing up in the diaspora and then turning against the very countries that they've grown up in. What are the factors? Because we're told a part of it, and some of, there's been some research done on this, there's this phenomenon called Prislam, that many of these people were kind of radicalized in prison. There's also the phenomenon of the of Wahhabi imams in various mosques. We know, for example, that's how the terrorists in Belgium were radicalized. So I take it it's a combination of factors, but what's your take on it since you've really essentially researched this in the deepest possible way?
It is indeed, you're absolutely right, Ian. It's a combination of different factors. And when we talk about the radicalization processes of people in the West, they are very different from people in the Middle East or in North Africa. There are different reasons. But if we talk about people in the West, you know, yes, Abdelhamid Abaoud, one of the plotters of the Paris attacks, and most of the people who participated with him in them. They were known to have had troubles long before. They came, interestingly, all from troubled families as well. And they all were known for other crimes, drugs, arms dealings, and they spent time in prison. And in prison, often it is, you know, those guys very often see themselves as already people who are discriminated against. So I spent a lot of time in the neighborhoods where they grew up, and I spoke to friends of the Paris and the Belgium attackers, and they would all tell me the same story. The story is the following. So here we were born as the children of parents who came from Morocco, Algeria, or Tunisia. We wanted to be Belgians at some stage or part of the Belgian society, but we felt we could never be part of the society because we grew up in this neighborhood, which is called Molenbeek. And whenever people heard that our name is Mohammed or Malika whatsoever, and we would send in our resumes and it says that we are from Molenbeek, we would not get a chance. And then we had no other chance than doing this crime or that crime. So why am I telling you this? Because they are describing themselves as being victims of the society and as feeling, you know, as basically feeling that they were no longer, they had no chance to be full members of the society, which actually led them towards this idea that, okay, we had no other chance but just to participate, you know, in those crimes. And then indeed, most of them ended up in prison. And then in prison, those criminals were put together with people who had been known in Belgium for a long time for spreading radical ideas. So they were in the same prison, and then those recruiters, as I call them, or the brainwashers, used the time in prison in order to recruit this person and basically tell him, look, you've been on the wrong path, you have been a criminal, but you know what? Everything will be forgiven to you, and yes, the society doesn't like you, and yes, you will never be a full member of the society, and forget also the society your parents came from, because I will give you a new identity, and the identity is the ideology that we are living, and we call it, you know, they call it Islam. I always say it's their own ideology. And this is how things sometimes start or could start. This is, you know, that's one story that I heard. But the common topic, and whether it's them or whether it was the ISIS commander that I sat with whom I interviewed in 2014, this guy, for example, did not come from a criminal background. It's actually quite the opposite. This guy spoke 5 languages. He did study. So did also, you know, Mohammed Emwazi, who we all know as Jihadi John. And he could have had a different life. He did not come from a background where he wouldn't have had a chance to become something. But this guy also mentioned the point of discrimination. And I think, Ian, that's a very, very important point we should discuss and always keep in mind. And again, this is not an excuse for the crimes, for the killings that they're doing. But if we want to understand how we can fight terrorism and extremism. We have to listen to how those guys talk about their own lives, and also we have to understand that apparently there was a moment in their lives where they felt they no longer belonged to the society. And I believe that it's exactly the point. The moment, you know, people who believe or who think that they can be a full member of a society, they will do whatever they can to protect it. The problem starts when people believe they are no longer a full member of a society or they are discriminated against because of their religious backgrounds. And this is the moment where recruiters play a very important role, and they know exactly how to challenge us, our society, by engaging more and more with those young people, with those men and women, and slowly but surely, winning them over for this ideology of ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Suhad McKennett. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Suhad McKennett, who's a correspondent for the Washington Post National Security Desk. She's also reported on terrorism for the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, and NPR. And she is the author of a new book just out, I Was Told to Come Alone, My Journey Behind the Lines of Jihad. So I take it then that going from a petty criminal into a kind of political criminal as a terrorist, the lines are not necessarily crossed in the sense that you actually are given a kind of license to kill. Isn't that the very nature of takfir and why it is a problem in itself and why I mentioned Wahhabi ideology? Because it would seem to me that if you misinterpret Islam in the way that the takfiris do, to believe that you have a religious sanction to kill, that's almost irresistible, isn't it?
Well, you know, but there's still also a very big step. We have to distinguish here between Wahhabis and takfiris. There's a very big difference here. A Wahhabi does not necessarily turn into a takfiri. A takfiri is actually going a step further. I would actually say that a lot of those members of ISIS that I met and talked to, they despise any form of religion or religious interpretation that comes from countries such as Saudi Arabia or the Middle East or North Africa, because they believe it's not really the real Islam. But yes, we have an issue indeed with people who believe that their ideology and their interpretation of Islam is the only truth. And in fact, that's a point I make in I Was Told to Come Alone, Ian, which is I find very often myself in a situation where I see that those guys are radicalizing religion, and it's not religion radicalizing the people. And let me also make one point very clear here, and I challenge in the book also and to a certain extent Muslim countries and the Muslim community, and I say we all have a role to play here in order to fight this and to work together in order to win over the hearts and minds of people. When I was in Saudi Arabia a year ago, and I went on a small, I was in Mecca, and there's something very interesting I realized when I went to the holy sites there. You know, men and women are together. So there is no separation of sexes. When you go into the Kaaba, you're basically in the area of the Kaaba, and you do your pilgrimage. Men and women are together. That's number one. Number two, a woman, when she does the pilgrimage, she's not supposed to cover her face. But so because because some scholars said if a woman's face has to be uncovered, otherwise this pilgrimage would not count. So I found myself actually then arguing with some of those scholars and I said, how can you ask men and women or to be separated from each other? What kind of interpretation is that if even there in the holiest site of Islam there is no separation? So this is and this is a discussion that has to happen within in the Muslim communities and Muslim countries, who actually has the right to say what is Islam and what is not Islam. And I think that's a big, big part, a large part of the problem. And takfiris, as you mentioned them, they, by the way, would also go after Muslims who don't believe, who don't live up to the standards that they have and who don't follow the ideology that they have. So that's actually a very important point to also make here.
Well, if there were to be the kind of debate that you're implying here, Suhad, you know, traditionally Egypt has had the leading role in Islamic scholarship. And my understanding is that before the Wahhabis and the Saudi royal family took over as custodians of Mecca and Medina, there was a lot more pluralism there. And there still is some, to some extent, I believe, still in Mecca and Medina, but it's definitely been shrunk. And that's what I find extraordinary, is this austere interpretation of Islam, where in fact, for example, the Prophet himself, his wife played a huge role in many ways, financed him in effect, and they tore her house down.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely, that's a very important point you made, Ian. Who are the people that that can speak in the name of Islam? And, you know, I find myself very often when I go into these interviews, when I describe this very in-depthly in I Was Told to Come Alone, in my book, when I go into these interviews, look, my parents are both descendants of the Prophet. My dad is Sunni, my mom is Shia. I mean, I'm a so-called Sufi. I was born and I was brought up in the West. I'm a child of a Western education, and I'm a unmarried woman. I'm a Muslim woman. And I very often struggle with exactly the point to understand why is it that those people should have or have the right to say what the Prophet wanted or what he did not want it. And you are absolutely right. The first wife of the Prophet, Khadija, she was a very strong person. She had a very strong personality. She was a businesswoman. She was older than him. I mean, everybody talks about President Macron and his wife, right, that he is younger than her. I mean, we had it in Islamic history that the first wife of the Prophet was, some people say, 15 years older than him. So here we have this very strong female figure, and then we have a situation today which, coming out of some people in Saudi Arabia or in the Gulf states, whether it's, now it's also Qatar to a certain extent because they have some preachers going on Al Jazeera sometimes that have also some weird ideas about how women should behave and be. So, and that's exactly the problem we have. They are not challenged. Now, in the case of Saudi Arabia, I'm describing also in one of the chapters how we actually got into this trouble. And I don't know if you remember, but in 1979, there was the siege of Mecca. And I described this siege of Mecca as one of the two events in 1979 that I believe played are still playing a huge role into the disaster we are in today. One was the siege of Mecca, and the other one was the return of Ayatollah Khomeini. Because if you look also at the situation of Iran in the 70s, it was a totally different country than it is today. So in the case of Saudi Arabia was in the 70s a different country from what it is today. And I sometimes really can't believe it when I speak to Saudi women who are telling me, look, before this whole situation, we had actually, the situation of women wasn't that bad. We had many more rights, but when the siege of Mecca happened, the Saudi royal family allowed the ulema, the members of the ulema, the members of the, you know, of the clerical council, to blackmail them to a certain extent in order to get the permission to send members of special forces in, and so that they could basically end the siege of Mecca. So a lot of people don't know those stories. They don't know that these countries that we see today as part of the sources for radical interpretation of Islam had a totally different, used to be different, and I'm trying to put this historical, all this in a historical context as well, and which is sometimes not easy for people to understand, but I think it's very important to tell also the story of, you know, what happened in Saudi Arabia or in Iran in 79.
Well, for the benefit of the audience, just give us a little more context, because are you suggesting, Suhad, that the beginning of the Shia-Sunni split, which certainly was opened wide by George Bush's and Dick Cheney's and Condoleezza Rice and Rumsfeld's hugely catastrophic invasion of Iraq, which opened up these fissures, and we know the chips were at the, and now there's an enormous amount of hostility, possibility of even a war in the Gulf, with Qatar being essentially cut off by Saudi Arabia because they're alleging that the Qatari royals are somehow playing footsie with the Iranian regime. So is that what you're suggesting? That because it was a Shia capture, was it not, in 79?
Well, what I'm suggesting is that this was, we had, since the death of the Prophet, there has always been a struggle between different forces about who should be the replacement of the Prophet. I mean, as you know, the whole idea, the whole group, the Shia group, emerged from this discussion, and Shias believed that, in fact, it should have been the son-in-law and / cousin of the Prophet Ali, that who was married to the Prophet's daughter, that he should have been the legitimate, you know, replacement. That it should be somebody from the Prophet's family who would have to replace the Prophet, while others believed, the majority believed, no, the replacement of the Prophet should be, you know, elected. And this has been going on for many, you know, hundreds of years. But the reason why I mentioned 79 is because what we saw since 79 is some kind of competition. I call it competition between, you know, this idea that emerged from Ayatollah Khomeini to spread Shiism into actually the Middle East and into the world, while on the other hand we had the members of the clerics in Saudi Arabia and the family members of Abdul Wahhab, who the founder of Wahhabism, who then said, well, if they spread Shiism, we have to spread Wahhabism. So, and that was just, I just mentioned that because you asked in one of your questions what role also Wahhabism played in this. And now this competition found also its way into Europe. So we saw in Europe, and then don't forget there was the war in Afghanistan as well that played a very important role, where, in fact, some Western intelligence agencies, with the help of Saudi Arabia, were trying to recruit people to fight against the Soviets under the pretext that they would fight a jihad. I mean, we all remember the movie Charlie Wilson's War, right, where it was actually also described in the way that when I speak to older members of ISIS or Al Qaeda who did participate in the war in Afghanistan, they told me, they said, look, there was a time where we received funds from U.S. embassies in order to buy a plane ticket and to go and fight against the Soviets. So in all this, you know, we have this mixture of competition between Iran and the Wahhabis. We have a lot of money coming into Europe, and then we have those people, those veterans, who returned from Afghanistan and who got a hold of money and started building up some mosques or became preachers, and were for many years able to preach this ideology. And for many years, unfortunately, the Europeans didn't really care. So, and I describe this in-depthly in my book, and if we look at the fact that three of the four 9/11 hijackers and pilots, I mean, those were three of the four pilots, they were recruited in Germany. They got radicalized in Germany, and it was possible because they ended up in a circle of people who were veterans from Afghanistan and the Bosnia War, and they were ended up in a circle of some mosques where nobody really understood where the money came from. And this is, I think, this kind of historical context is very important for people to understand if we want to know how was it possible actually that, or how is it possible that some men and women who lived in Europe or who were born in Europe and grew up in Europe then, got under the influence of some recruiters and ideology.
Well, that's why your book is so important.
Thank you so much.
Because it begins to answer these incredible questions. Obviously, you cannot bomb this phenomenon out of existence. And there is a spiritual element to it, a theocratic element to it. And that is obviously the only way that it can be dealt with. So I thank you for your bravery in meeting with these people and bringing insight to the public about who these people are. And I thank you for joining us, Suhad.
Thanks for having me, Ian. Thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with Suhad McKennitt, who is a correspondent for the Washington Post National Security Desk, who has also reported on terrorism for the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, and NPR. She's the co-author of The Eternal Nazi, Children of Jihad and Islam, and was the 2012 Nieman Fellow at Harvard University, and is a visiting fellow at the Weatherhead Center for International Policy at Harvard, the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Her latest book just out is I Was Told to Come Alone, My Journey Behind the Lines of Jihad. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and look further into Saudi Arabia's petrodollar finance spread of Wahhabism.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. You bought a lot of money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephen Kinzer, who has written about U.S. intervention in books including All the Shah's Men, Overthrow, and Bitter Fruit, an award-winning foreign correspondent with the New York Times. He is now a visiting fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University and contributes to the New York Review of Books and is a columnist for The Guardian in the U.K. And his latest book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, chaos and their secret world war. And he has an op-ed at the Boston Globe, Saudi Arabia is destabilizing the world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Kinzer.
Good to be here.
And at this point, Saudi Arabia is certainly destabilizing the Gulf. And it's a pretty odd to watch the Secretary of State sort of toiling in the diplomatic vineyards trying to stop this thing getting out of hand, and President Trump throwing fire on the flames, obviously at the behest of the Saudis. So what do you make of that?
I think you're seeing something happening in the Gulf region itself, which is a result of changes that have happened there in recent years and even in recent months, as you point out. But in addition to what you see Saudi Arabia doing at this particular moment, in this particular conflict in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia has also been active in a much broader and much longer-term project. Saudi Arabia has spent decades trying to promote its extreme form of Islam by sending religious teachers to Muslim countries around the world, building mosques, building religious schools, creating organizations and supporting scholars to come to Saudi Arabia and learn this forbidding brand of Islam. So you can pick out half a dozen countries in the world today where there's clearly a decisive surge of radical Islamic organization and trace that back to operations that Saudi Arabia launched years and decades ago.
Well, the record's pretty clear. The Saudis were the only supporters, along with Pakistan, of the Taliban. They, more recently, with the ISIS attacks, we've learned, for example, in Kosovo, all the mosques have been taken over by the Wahhabis. And we also learned that the mosques in Paris were where some of the attackers were radicalized. And the same is true in Brussels. The attackers there were radicalized by a Wahhabi imam at a mosque in Brussels. And I keep wondering, though, about sort of Einstein's definition of insanity. Why is it that we keep turning a blind eye? We turn a blind eye to the Pakistanis' duplicity, and we turn a blind eye to the Saudi Arabian duplicity. Is it simply because of oil and money?
I think there are a variety of factors. Certainly, money is a big factor. Saudi Arabia is a massive consumer of American-made weapons. I think also the American fixation on Iran as a font of all evil feeds into the narrative that Saudi Arabia, as Iran's enemy, is the great defender of all of what we hold good in that part of the world. In turn, the intense fixation on Iran that characterizes American foreign policy is driven in part, I think, by Israel, which is whipping up that fervor in Washington. If Israel were, for whatever reason, to decide that Iran was no longer a threat and Iran was okay, I think the air would go out of the anti-Iran balloon in Washington very quickly. So the Saudi thing is a particularly interesting example of how the United States not only finds itself facing a very daunting and many-tentacled foe, but it's a foe that we have fed ourselves. You said that Saudi Arabia and Pakistan were the principal supporters of the Taliban. But, of course, if you go back to the founding of what became the Taliban, you see the United States already involved there, too. I think when it comes to the Persian Gulf, you also see a reflection of a real deeper problem in American foreign policy, which is that we don't change our foreign policy when the world changes. We have great policies to deal with situations that no longer exist. We're not agile. In the Persian Gulf in particular, for example, the United States felt that we needed to dominate the Gulf because we had two interests there. Number one, keep the Soviet Union out. Number two, secure those waters because we received the lifeblood of our economy from Saudi oil. Now, that situation has changed. There's no Soviet Union, and we don't depend on Saudi oil. Nonetheless, our policy is still the same. We're still insisting on dominating the Persian Gulf and taking sides in its disputes. You could argue that that might have made sense at a time when we had real strategic interest in the Gulf, but it doesn't make sense anymore. It's another example of the inertia that allows us to be dragged down by outdated foreign policies and not confront the idea that maybe we ought to adapt them to new circumstances.
So is there then a problem, though, in the revolving door in Washington with diplomats and intelligence people going into sort of jobs with Saudi banks, etc.? I'm trying to get an understanding for why it is that the blindness about 15 of the 19 hijackers from 9/11 being Saudis, the continual deference to Saudi Arabia, and I mean, just recently, for example, Saudi Arabia played Australia in soccer for the World Cup, and there was a minute of silence for the victims of the London attacks, and the Saudi players refused to take part in it. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary that they said they have cultural differences. So what is your understanding of, though, apart from the oil and the money, which is certainly significant, is there also some kind of way that Saudi money has captured Washington?
Absolutely. Saudi Arabia has run a very well-oiled and very well-financed publicity machine in the United States. Prince Bandar, the longtime Saudi ambassador in Washington, was an intimate friend of presidents. He was the social star of the Washington party scene. Because of him, every presidential library, for example, has received large donations from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia donated jewelry for Nancy Reagan and has been lavishing these kinds of gifts on Americans for decades. We have an odd relationship with the Saudis because we've made ourselves believe a narrative that they fed us. And there was so much money involved that I think we were eager to turn our faces away from the truth. I also think, as a journalist, that the story of how this global project developed, the project of Saudi Arabia trying to pull many nations back to 7th century Islam, we can see a real weakness in the press and maybe in the political and diplomatic imagination. We're always focused on news stories that are breaking today. There's been a bomb going off somewhere. As soon as that story's over, we're on to the next bridge collapse. So we're so focused on instantaneous news and the press of the continual news cycle that we have lost the ability to pull back and look at larger trends and stories that actually are more important than today's news. The story of how the Saudis penetrated Central Asia, North Africa, Southeast Asia with their religious ideology, producing the effects we're seeing today, never really was told while it was unfolding. And I think journalists as well as diplomats turned our heads away and also were too focused on daily events. I think we need to learn from this that we should look more deeply at what's happening behind the scenes of the headlines. And this, I think, is a great weakness of the press that feeds the ability of world leaders to misshape global politics.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Kinzer, who's written about U.S. intervention in books including All the Shah's Men, Overthrow, and Bitter Fruit, an award-winning foreign correspondent with the New York Times. He is a visiting fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University and contributes to the New York Review of Books and is a columnist for The Guardian. And his latest book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. And he has an op-ed at the Boston Globe, Saudi Arabia is Destabilizing the World. So let's turn from the manifestly clear history of Saudi Wahhabi influence behind Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, ISIS, all of that we know is pretty clear on the record, yet somehow they are still our best ally, and our president was recently over there having a good time with them because they treated him well and they invest in his properties, as opposed to the Qataris, who didn't, and look what's happening to them. Let's turn to Indonesia, as you have written in your new piece at the Boston Globe. Saudi Arabia is destabilizing the world, the largest Muslim country on the planet, and normally a country that is quite mild in terms of its religiosity, a very loose, forgiving, gentle country, as I remember it, very sensual and very lovely people. And yet now you're getting this kind of ugliness in terms of the politics of hate.
And this is not an accident. As I pointed out in my column, Indonesia is suddenly showing terrible signs of religious intolerance. The most public one was the recent episode of the governor of Jakarta, who's a Christian and was seeking re-election, suddenly seizing on the pretext of some remark this guy made. Groups of radical Muslims took to the streets by the tens of thousands, denouncing this guy. And he went from looking like a pretty sure thing to be reelected as governor of Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, to going to jail for blasphemy, which is where he's sitting now. And this is an example of the power that militant Islamic groups are now wielding in Indonesia. This is remarkable because, as you point out, Indonesia is a country known for its diversity, and tolerance is a fundamental virtue in any country as diverse as that. So it's not surprising to find out that many of the organizers of these protests aimed at intimidating judges promoting candidates in democratic elections who are dedicated to destroying democratic rights once they get to power is Saudi Arabian influence. Many of these leaders have attended a university in Jakarta that is funded by Saudi Arabia. The best students are then brought to Saudi Arabia for further training in this extremist form of Islam. They come back and try to foment movements that are trying to pull Indonesia away from its more syncretic and mixed and tolerant traditions back towards the 7th century Islam of the Salafists. So the news that there was an episode in Indonesia and the governor suddenly was arrested and put in jail did burst into our consciousness. But that's not the real big story. The larger story is why this happened. And when you follow the dots back, you see Saudi influence there. It is a very impressive example of how, while many countries in the West were saying it's a waste of money to promote ideas and have cultural attachés and try to spread our view of the world, the Saudis were taking a very different view. They were pouring millions of dollars into promoting their worldview, and we're now seeing the results everywhere from Mumbai to Manchester.
And my understanding is that it comes down to the compact that the Saudi royal family, the Al Saud family, and it is a family business that runs Saudi Arabia, and they're immensely wealthy, as we know, from the oil, but it's also a country with enormous, actually almost one-third poverty, and the royals are so paranoid that they don't even have a military. They've broken it up into three different separate militaries, and may explain why they're having such a tough time in Yemen. So we know that the Al Sauds only care about their own longevity, and the reason that they're going after Qatar in part is to do with their fear of political Islam in the form of the Muslim Brotherhood, because they don't want anybody in the Islamic world to have any other form of government except their medieval version. And they're also funding the Egyptian government to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood, which they succeeded in doing. So the compact, I understand, with the Wahhabis is that you guys keep the public completely brain dead from the austerity of this religious imposition on your life, but at the same time, preach obedience to us and we'll let you go, do your own thing, and we'll fund you. Is that, I know that's a kind of rather superficial way of describing it, but describe your understanding of the compact.
You're right that this regime, the Saudi Arabia regime, which is built on a family that took power in the 1930s, is based on a compact between the ruling family and the establishment of a Salafist Islam, what we call Wahhabist Islam. So the principles of this are essentially, as they play out, as follows. This austere religious group, first of all, hates all Western influence and hates the kind of sinful life which they believe characterizes everything we do in the West. So normally they would be strongly opposed to the Saudi regime. This regime has close ties to the Western powers that these religious leaders detest. And the 6,000 princes live lives that are hardly models of Muslim abstinence and chastity. So it's important for the survival of the regime that the religious establishment turn a blind eye to these realities and not criticize either the excesses of the princes and other members of the royal family or the relations of the regime with the Western countries that they consider so corrupt. In exchange for turning this blind eye and for endorsing a regime that behaves in ways that you would think they should abhor, the regime then provides these clerics with vast financial resources and tells them, you can go ahead and preach this extreme form of Islam, but just don't do it here at home. Just keep us out of your range of fire and go out into the rest of the world, and we'll give you that, and we'll give you the money to promote our project in the rest of the world, but at home, you have to work to keep us in power, otherwise you won't have these resources to do your propaganda in the rest of the world. So that's essentially the deal that has produced this situation in the world today.
So what is going on with our government in terms of not wanting to look at the consequences of spreading Wahhabism and destabilizing or radicalizing countries like, as we mentioned, Afghanistan, Pakistan, these mosques throughout Europe that have been the ones that inspired these terrorists who attacked inside of Europe. And then more recently, as you pointed out in your article, Stephen Kinzer, at the Boston Globe, Saudi Arabia is destabilizing the world. They are now having an influence in Indonesia, and they could turn Indonesia into a hostile, anti-Western radical country, which would have enormous consequences for the U.S. because the U.S., you know, supported the Indonesian revolution where millions were killed, as far as we know, because in part because of the, what they call the SLOCs, the sea lanes of communication, the Straits of Malacca. There are all kinds of geostrategic reasons why the U.S. supports Indonesia. And then, of course, on top of that, Australia's right next door, and that surely a radicalized Indonesia is going to have a very adverse effect on Australia. So, and that's Australia is a part of the ANZUS Treaty. So I just don't get it. Do you?
I think there's a larger problem here that explains a little bit of our inability to grasp the realities that you just enumerated. In Washington, there's very little room for real debate about central questions of foreign policy. There's a broad consensus shared by almost all Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals. It's based on the idea of American hegemony. It's the idea that the United States keeps the world together. We're the indispensable nation. We stand taller. We see further. We know what's good for the world, and we need to be involved in every conflict. So the idea, for example, that Saudi Arabia and Iran could joust for dominance in the Middle East and try to figure out some kind of balance of power between themselves without the United States taking sides seems sort of unpatriotic. It's un-American. We need to be involved in every conflict everywhere in the world. And when you take sides, of course you take sides with your friends, but you also make new enemies. We've been in the business of making enemies in the Middle East for a long time, and we're taking a dramatic new step in that direction now. So I think it's this deadening consensus in Washington that tells us we know who our friends are. Our friends are Pakistan, Israel, Saudi Arabia. It's always been that way. It always will be that way. Don't try to pull us away from this. the punishment for imaginative or out-of-the-box thinking in foreign policy in Washington is absolute. You can't eat lunch in Washington if you question that approach to politics. So to me, the lack of debate over these larger questions of foreign policy is something that helps explain why we continue to follow policies that are so undermining of our own security.
So what will it take? I mean, 9/11 wasn't enough, apparently, and somehow the Saudis managed to dodge that bullet. Remember, you remember the 28 pages that were classified, finally were released. A lot of people still are not happy with that. They still think there's a bunch of avenues that weren't explored in terms of what was in those 28 pages. So if you accept the premise that this is incredible duplicity that's going on here, the Saudis must be laughing all the way at us. They must think we're the biggest fools on the planet.
I do think they must feel that they played Trump like a fiddle. It was perfect when you look back at how they did it. They brought him over there. They had these cringe-inducing ceremonies with the sword dance and the laying of hands on the glowing orb. Then they announced this $115 billion arms deal. They gave him this luxurious welcome. They told him how much they loved him. Then he announced that he would be on their side to fight terror, which is in itself kind of mind-boggling. And then with that endorsement, as soon as Trump was gone, the Saudis decided it's time to strike out against our next enemy, Qatar, and see if we can use the power of Trump's endorsement to crush a little country near us that has defied our power. So I feel like that when you ask what it will take, I think it would take a reassessment of our entire role in the Middle East, which would entail asking ourselves, with which countries do we really have common interests? We need a little zero-based foreign policy. Let's start fresh and not bring in our cliches and everything we think about the past and look at these countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Pakistan also, if you want to go beyond the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iran, and ask ourselves, what kind of a foreign policy would serve our interests? Because for too long, our foreign policy in that part of the world has been shaped to favor the interests of our client states there, not us. It's the tail wagging the dog syndrome. And I don't see that happening as long as there is the kind of political deadlock we see in Washington now. It's highly disturbing because the confrontation between Iran and Saudi Arabia is full of destabilizing potential. You ask, what could it take on something on a 9/11 level? If this is just anything more than scattered proxy conflicts between Iran and Saudi Arabia, that could be the flare that could set off a major conflict in the Middle East. And if that happens, certainly Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia, when he encouraged the Saudis to set off on this latest round of aggression, might be seen as something like the Princip assassination of Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo.
It began World War I. Well, I thank you very much, Stephen Kinzer. I appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Kinzer, who has written about the U.S. interventions in books, including All the Shah's Men, Overthrow and Bitter Fruit, an award-winning foreign correspondent with the New York Times. He's a visiting fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University and contributes to the New York Review of Books and is a columnist for The Guardian of the UK. And his latest book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles and Their Secret World War. And he has an op-ed at the Boston Globe, Saudi Arabia is Destabilizing the World. And again, this is Beam Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.